Okay. I think I've got it working now. So experiment. Dan knows how to work this. I don't. But this morning we were talking about our past, and we were talking about the old sock hops at Brickett Wood. We had dancers only. We were in socks. We had a highly polished floor in the gymnasium. And they used to polish that up, and we used to dance around in socks. And I don't know why that came up. But another thing that used to happen in those days, we had the Ambassador Club and Spokesman's Club, and if you spoke for too long, you got buzzed. But I have been told that I'll be buzzed if I speak for under 30 minutes, because Judy has got her children and she wants to get involved with those. So I said, I'll do my best. I'll be buzzed if I'm under 30 minutes. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
And about 100 years ago, about the time, it was started before the sock hop era, I used to do a lot of climbing in North Wales and in Snowdonia. And I got very familiar with the Snowdon Horseshoe, and then there's the Gledders, there's Trevann, and the Carnarvon Range. And I got very familiar with them. And, I enjoyed it. At least I enjoyed talking about it. It's not quite so good when you're out in the mist and the rain's coming down and you want to be doing something else. But at that in those days, there was a book I used to read a lot, and it was called I Bought a Mountain, by a fellow called Thomas Furbank. Have you ever heard of I Bought a Mountain? But anyway, a Canadian citizen, he bought this a farm in North Wales. And the whole book is about this farm. It's about the farming life in the 30s, mainly in the 1930s. Very fascinating book, but I practically wore it out when I was reading it. But what I didn't know until more recently was that during the war he went on and he joined the Coldstream Guards. And in fact, from the Coldstream Guards started an airborne division, and he joined that. And he served through the war. He was in North Africa, he was in Italy, he ended up in Arnhem. He became a lieutenant colonel, and he got the Military Cross. So I didn't know about this until recently, and he wrote a book called I Bought a Star. And there was one quote in this book which I want to read. Because, freeing from an ordinary farmer, he became a lieutenant colonel in the parachute regiment. And to quote, he says, "It is a pity that the officer class is often misrepresented. The good officer is both protector to his men and father confessor. In active fighting units, he does not retain his command if he is idle, inefficient or out of tune with his subordinates. It is only the officer uncertain of himself who dare not mix intimately with the other ranks. The heredity of the traditional leader class teaches that men are best served, best led by serving them." And that quote stuck out in that book. Now, I can't remember when it was, but Richard gave a series of sermons on Ephesians. And in one of those sermons, he quoted from Ephesians 5:25. And it's about husbands and wives, but there's a principle of leadership here, so I'll read it. Husbands, love your... I'll wait a second.
No, don't.
You've all heard it many, many times. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without spot or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated their own body, but they feed and care for their body, just as Christ does the church, for we are members of his body. Now, this quote is talking about husbands, the way husbands should treat wives. However, it is a principle of leadership, Christian leadership. Now, I learned quite a lot about this principle from a group of people that I grew up with, military officers. And my mother and my father were both military officers. My mother was a nurse in Burma, an army nurse in Burma during the war. In fact, when she got there, she complained that all she did was deliver babies, but that's not what she went there for. But at the end, she did more serious stuff. And my father as well, he served, well, he joined the army before the war in 1935. And all his working life, he was an officer with the army. Well, the last 10 years of his working life, he was a civil servant, but he was still in the same seat as he was when he retired as an officer. But my father, like Thomas Furbank, he served through the war. And he served, first of all, he was in France at the beginning of the war, Dunkirk, and then after a bit of time on the home front, they sent him off to the Middle East, and then Italy for about 9 months solid fighting, and then ending up basically the same war as Thomas Furbank. He was in Ardenham, and then he went off onto Germany from there. But in Italy, he won a military cross, and he lived. The officers lived by what is called the officer code, and basically, it's summed up by. Now, there is a quote. It's not just the British Army who the officers lead from the front. Every army, if you want to get anything done for your men, you have to lead from the front. And in the Indian Army, they have a Sandhurst as well. I don't think Dehradun, I think it's called. But they in gold letters up in the hall, the Chetwood Hall, they have this. They said, "The safety, honour and welfare of your country come first, always and every time. The honour, welfare and comfort of the men you command come next. Your own ease, comfort and safety come last, always and every time." So for a good officer, his own safety and his own comfort always come bottom of the list. And so he was quite a tough act to follow. He lived by that code all his life. He was always when he had guests, he was always the last one to sit down. Always, you know, always making sure everybody was comfortable, everybody had drinks. He was always the last to sit down. If he was on a bus, he was always the one to get up, you know, for somebody to sit down. And so, as I say, he was a tough act to follow. But he did once say this to me, and it stuck. He said, "If one of your men loses his gloves or his water bottle, some clown forgets to bring his sleeping bag, you give him yours. You give him yours. You might be practically crying, and when you get back to barracks, you will probably murder him. But out in the field, you look after your men." And that was the way he operated. This is, I mean, to me, that is a that, I mean, I will read that quote about from Ephesians 5:25 again. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave herself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without spot or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but they feed and care for their body, just as Christ does the church, for we are members of his body. And as I say, my father was quite a very, very good example of this, the way he treated his wife, my mother, and the way he treated us, and the way he treated his men. In fact, in the 1950s, one of his wartime drivers ended up in the same regiment as us. And one day he was chatting with my mother, and he said they'd no business giving the major an MC. What he should have got was a posthumous VC. That was what they thought of him. So I say, husbands obviously have to lead by examples, and as Christians we have to lead by example as well. And show those we are responsible for love. Now, what is it that we actually mean when we're talking about love? Now, anybody who's been in the church for 10 or 20 minutes will know that there are three Greek words for love. Now, you're all familiar with them. You've got philia. Philia, that is brotherly love. And one has the impression when Jesus said, do you love me? Do you agape me? And I'll deal with that word in a minute. Philia, and Peter said, I philia you, that he was sort of being, he wasn't showing Jesus real love. But philia can be very, very intense indeed. And I'll give you an example of philia. Philia is the love that soldiers who have faced death in action together. That's what the sort of love that they feel for each other. Very, very intense love. And I'll read you this quote by an officer, a British officer who served with the Gurkhas during the First World War. And this is an example of philia. And at the end of a book that he wrote, as I write these last words, my thoughts return to you, who are my comrades, the stubborn and indomitable peasants of Nepal. Once more I hear the laughter with which you greeted every hardship. Once more I see you in your bivouacs or about your fires, on forced marches or in the trenches, now shivering with wet and cold, now scorched by the pitiless and burning sun. Uncomplaining, you endure hunger and thirst and wounds, and at the last your unwavering lines disappear into the smoke and the wrath of battle. And this is where I can't read this bit without tears coming to my eyes. Bravest of the brave, most generous of the generous, never had country more faithful friends than you. So philia can be very, very intense. And when Peter said that he philia'd Jesus, it wasn't a secondary love at all. It was a very emotional statement. We've also heard There's also the word eros, which of course refers to married love, the love you have for one human being. But the word I want us for love, I want to zero in, is agape. Agape is the love of sacrifice. That is when you... Agape is the love when you... Somebody wants you to go 1 mile, you do two. It's if you see somebody who's cold, you give him a coat. If your enemy is hungry, you give him drink. Give him food. If he's thirsty, you give him drink. That is basic agape. Agape is actively living for others. Now, that is the Greek. Now, in the Greek, basically, I'm playing away, because luckily we have a congregation in Abercomboy, and there's a Greek guy there, and he speaks Greek. So any time I want to know a Greek word or how to pronounce it, I can go to him, so I don't make an ass of myself when I'm up here. And so he's very useful for Greek. But when I'm quoting Hebrew, I'm playing at home. I'm playing at home on the home ground, because, you know. Now, let's talk about Hebrew words for love, because they're a little bit more precise. Now, when you talk about the general Hebrew word for love, and I think I've covered this before, but I'll say it again anyway. The word is ahava, or when you say, I love somebody, just the general word, it basically means exactly what it means in English. You can say, I love shish kebab, I love you, I love tennis. It's a very general, broad word, and it's not very useful because it's so broad, it's, you know... And, but there are other words which express different shades of love. Now, one word that is tzedakah. You've got that in the word Melchizedek. You've got Zedekiah, Zedekiahu. You've got words in the Bible with tzedek in it. Tzedakah means righteousness. But the thing is. That the word in English righteousness doesn't cut it at all. It's if you give to charity, you are doing tzedakah. If you do somebody a favour, you're doing tzedakah. If you give somebody a coat when he's cold, you're doing tzedakah. Is the doing bit of God's love. It's what you do. It is. Going the second mile, it's even dying for your enemy. That is the doing part of God's love. And the word righteousness, it doesn't really do it. So tzedakah is actively living for others. Now that's the doing bit, but there's another Hebrew word called chesed. Have you heard the word chesed? Okay. Chesed is normally translated loving kindness. Loving kindness. And now there's a song we sing in messianic circles a lot. Hodu ladonai ki tov ki le'olam hosto. I'm not going to sing to you. But give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his loving kindness endures forever. I think that's Psalm 42. But we used to sing that a lot. And that is the love which makes you want to do these things. When you have love for somebody, what you do seems a privilege. You want to do it. And that's what God's Holy Spirit, that's what God's love within you does. You're not only doing these things, like giving somebody a coat when he's cold, feeding your enemy and giving him drink and everything, and going the second. You're not only doing these things, but you're doing it because you want to, because you love them. So that's the chesed. Chesed is the attitude of wanting to do these things, and Tzedakah is actually doing it. They've got to go together. You have, if you just have a feeling of, feeling very, very sorry for somebody and your heart goes out to them and you do nothing, that's just sentimentality. But if you're doing the whole time and you don't really want to do it, but you're doing it because you've got to do it, then that's just cold duty. You've got to have the chesed and you've got to have the tzedakah together. And that's the way it works. Now, let me see. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 13 verse 4. 1 Corinthians 13 verse 4. You know, when I used, for about 8 or 9 years, I did voluntary work. I did about 4 years in Hull, working for Exabus, and I did another about 4 years in Jerusalem, working in a Christ church in Jerusalem. And we were working very hard indeed. And at the same time, we were surrounded by all these fluffy Christians everywhere. They didn't seem to do anything except be fluffy Christians. They didn't actually do anything. And I was always, you know, in those days, I was a real Martha, you know. Well, the male version of Martha? But anyway, Martha was my girl. You know, if I'd met Martha, then I'd have married her on the spot because Martha actually got off her backside and did something while Mary just sat there. You know, that was my attitude at the time. But anyway, so love, right? So love suffers long. Love is long-suffering and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It is not puffed up. It doesn't behave rudely. It does not seek its own. It's not provoked. It thinks no evil. It does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. So, and then going on to James 2, verse 14. I'll find it. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith, but does not have works, can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have work, is dead. So this is talking about you've got to actually do as well as think. Now, Revelation 2 verse 1. Talking to the church in Ephesus. Again, this is talking to Martha's like me. To the angel of the church of Ephesus, write, these things says he who holds the 7 stars in his right hand, who walks in the midst of the 7 golden lampstands. I know your works, your labour, your patience, and that you cannot bear those who are evil. And you have tested those who say they are apostles and are not, and have found them liars. And you have persevered and have patience. and have laboured for my name's sake, and have not become weary. Nevertheless, I have this against you, that you have left your first love. Now, as I've said, through the years, I have been a Martha, you know. I've been the one sort of doing a lot of the work and watching all these fluffy people not doing anything. But actually, these fluffy Christians had something I didn't. They had a love. They had a zeal. They were good encouragers as well. I will give them that. A lot of them did have a lot of God's Spirit in them. And when you're busy, that God's Spirit can sort of go down and down and down. I mean, your tank is practically empty. But do you remember when I was talking about the tabernacle? I once gave a talk on the tabernacle in here. You can picture the tabernacle in front of you. And you've got the outer courtyard, and the outer courtyard, you've got the white linen screen on the outside. That represents God's righteousness, is the doing part of God's love. And in the centre of the tabernacle, in the centre of the courtyard, near one end of it, you've got the tabernacle itself. And at the back of the tabernacle, you've got the Holy of Holies. That's God's throne. Now, when we are approaching the tabernacle as human beings, obviously, we have to go through the gate of the courtyard to get into the tabernacle. We go past the altar and then through that way. But that's not the way the Bible is written. The Bible is written by God, from God's point of view. And when the construction of the tabernacle starts in Exodus 24, and if I was writing it, I'd say, well, you build the outer courtyard, and then when we've done that, you build the altar, and you build this and you build that, and gradually build. It starts from the other end, because God's throne is there. He says, first of all, you build it, you make the Ark of the Covenant. And he starts by describing how you build the Ark of the Covenant, and he works up towards us. Okay? And then he ends up by the outside of the tabernacle, because he is God. He's coming out towards us. And now the point is this. God comes out to us. If he didn't come out towards us, we would not be able to come towards him. Because we would not, you know, there is no way we can get to God on our own. But God provided his son, Jesus, to die. He was a human being, and he took the penalty of our sins on himself, and he took the death penalty for our sins on himself. And if he hadn't done that, we would not be able to go towards him. We'd be dead in the water. And so that's, I mean, that is quite a thought. And I was going to say something just now, but I forgot. It was a brilliant thing I was going to say. It came to mind, and it's just gone. But going back to the tradition of the army officer who has to his comfort is always the last. It's always the last priority. Imagine Jesus as an army officer. And he's not only prepared to give you his sleeping bag, or his gloves, or his water bottle. He's not only prepared to do that. He's prepared to give his life for anyone of you. And he's not only prepared to do it, he's doing it because he wants to do it. You know, obviously the average army officer doesn't want to give you his gloves or his water bottle. He's practically crying, but he will do it because he's got to do it. But in Jesus' case, he does it because he wants to do it, because he loves us. That's the thing. And again, going back to Ephesians 5:25, if a husband or anybody else, as Richard sort of, there was a kind of throwaway comment at the time, women in a relationship, or wives, they like men, they like acts of love and consideration and tenderness. I'm not a woman, so I don't know about these things. But they like acts of love and consideration and tenderness and the odd bar of chocolate now and again. And you know, being pampered occasionally, you know, and being understood. You know, women like these sort of things. Men crave respect. They go together. Men like respect. Women like acts of love. And if a husband acts like this towards his wife, basically the respect comes with rations. You know, it just, as Richard pointed out, respect is something you earn. It's not something you expect. It's something you earn. If a husband or a leader, a Christian leader, acts in this way, and goes before, just as a shepherd goes before the sheep, then the respect will be there. And I'll leave you with that. And I'll try and switch this thing off. But, I'm bound to be closed.